Welcome to episode 259 of Allied Strategies. My name is Tristan, joined as always by my friend Benjamin.
Hello.
Hello. And my friend Sam.
So I have a point of order question.
That is certainly welcome and expected.
Wow. Well, I didn't think it was going to be expected. We didn't do an episode last week, right?
Should the episode number increment by two? Is that your question?
That was going to be my question. Yeah, like, do the episodes denote the number of weeks it's been, or are they each time we put out something? Because if so, then our tiny podcast
should have had
a number as well.
This is one of the dumbest questions I've ever heard.
I agree with Benjamin. It's so clear that your episode number should not go up if you don't do a podcast for a week. Every single TV show in history that takes, you know, a week off for a holiday, or, you know, 13 weeks off in the middle of their season and then they come back, you don't just randomly go from episode 7 to episode 20 on those things. That would be
okay. Well, so what happened? What about the tiny episode that Ben produced?
That one is a little bit more, you know, you could maybe make some argument that should have counted as an episode or something. There are reasonable questions surrounding that.
I thought it did count as an episode. I thought you told me it was.
It was an episode, but does it count as an episode? Yeah, does it get numbered, right? Does it get numbered, and does it come in as a decimal point? Is it episode 251.1 or episode 251 part 2 or something like that? Or is it just, you know... There's a legitimate question there, but if there's just a week that you missed, obviously you just come back next week and you increase the episode number by one.
Tristan, should you tell everyone our main topic before we go way too far down this rabbit hole?
I believe the time to do that has passed. However, I will attempt to salvage the situation, as I always find myself doing on this show. Yes, our main topic this week is we are going to have a discussion with Benjamin about the metagame of the tournament for which you've been preparing that you are calling Worlds.
You call it a discussion. I call it an interrogation.
Yeah. Okay.
It's Worlds 2020. If I win, I will be the world champion for the year of 2020, and no one can convince me otherwise.
If you lose, will you be happy to disavow it being Worlds?
No.
If I got a 10-second video of Richard Garfield telling you were not the world champion, would that convince you otherwise?
No. Richard Garfield has no authority over who is and is not the world champion of Magic the Gathering. If you're going to try to appeal to an authority figure, you would do better to choose, like, the people in charge of OP or whatever.
Okay, how about if it's like... Yeah, but that's, like, not as cool. If it's, like, Scott or whatever, no one really cares.
I was going to say something that I might have later regretted, and I will choose not to say that thing instead.
That is remarkably fortunate for you. Yes, I don't know. Richard Garfield's an interesting one because he's, you know, coming off of the Artifact kind of not going as well, right? So I feel like his name has lost a little bit of cred, right? A little bit less of a...
I don't really think so. I mean, obviously you're going to have some misses with your hits. Like, he's been pretty consistent about designing, like, games that people really like, right?
That's true, yeah. He did Netrunner as well, right?
He did what?
Netrunner?
He's done a ton. I mean, he's made so many games. My sort of takeaway from playing some of his games and reading what he writes is that he loves ideas and tries sort of all of them and sort of plays them out to their conclusion. And sometimes they're not as good as some other ones. Like I played some games of his that I didn't like that much and some games that I thought were really, really good. But that he's also a genius is basically, like, he just tries a bunch of stuff. He puts out a ton of games, and most of them I think are good.
Yeah, I definitely think that's fair. I think it's hard to have even two good games by accident. I think one good game by accident is a possibility, but two is where it stops being really a possibility.
Yeah.
But even if he said Benjamin wasn't a world champion, Ben wouldn't believe it or respect it for some reason. So really kind of deeply insulting to the founder of Magic.
What? I mean, he's just not the authority on who is and is not the world champion.
Either way, this discussion of what would happen if Ben wins the tournament is largely moot anyways. So Not too. Yeah, it's not worth dwelling too much on it. it's a pure hypothetical. Wait,
so if I do win, can I get a promise from both of you to call me the world champion the next time we do the podcast?
No, you can get a promise from me to try to get a video of Richard Garfield telling you you're not the world champion.
All right, I'll accept that.
And I will try and get a video of Sam trying to get a video of Richard Garfield telling you you're not the world champion. Anyways, that's going to be our main topic this week. We're going to talk about Ben's quest to earn a title that he can't even earn from the tournament that he's competing in. but first, before we get to that, let's thank our supporters over at patreon.com. The illustrious friends of the podcast are Kiki Jiki, Kyle, JetchMT, Baptiste Jr., Bobby, and Luke. The good friends of the podcast are Adam, Zach, Britton, Kyle, Caroline, Eric, Sam, Duncan, Wilson, Tobias, Paul,
Jarvis, Kismet, you,
Boosha Therapy, Greg, Hot Soup, Ari, Rob, Matthew, Brent, Moosh's Bot.
Sorry, I have to untap from the Kismet that Ben played on me. Winchester,
Asher, Dan, Dunn, Alex, and Will. Thanks all for your support. Winchester was very confused last episode when their name got swapped. There was a shenanigan played. That's all that can be said. Any time you're somewhat confused about really anything on the show, there's a good chance that some shenanigan was involved. See if you can catch what happens this week. Let's move on, though, to our card of the week. Benjamin, what is your card of the week?
My card of the week is Kroxa, Titan of something death-related. I think it's probably Death's Hunger, but, you know, who the hell knows. Kroxa is a 6/6 Elder Giant for black-red. When it enters the battlefield, sacrifice it unless it escaped. When it enters the battlefield, each opponent discards a card from their hand and loses 3 life unless they discarded a non-land. And then it has Escape BBRR. Exile 5 other cards from your graveyard. So this is the last Titan standing in Standard, at least. And we'll talk a little bit about it later, but, you know, Uro gets some harsh rap for being, like, really replayable and not that fun. And I found that Kroxa is something similar. Like, once your opponent gets Kroxa going, it's really hard to get out from under it. And it sort of has the same problematic play patterns that Uro does, where they can just sort of cast it over and over again. It's not as consistent to cast over and over again as Uro, because Uro feeds itself, whereas Kroxa, like, tries to deny resources from your opponent. And Uro prolongs the game by gaining life and drawing cards, and Kroxa shortens the game by dealing your opponent damage. But I found that, you know, this card I have not really been enjoying playing against or playing with, so I feel like the Elder Giants were just a total miss for me in terms of fun. Like, these cards, the way the escape mechanic works for something of this power level is just really, really frustrating to play against. And Kroxa, you know, is finally seeing some play in Standard now that Uro is banned. And it's been pretty good in Historic, in the black-red Kroxa deck, basically. So, yeah, I don't know. This might be a card that I'm complaining about until, you know, rotation. It's one saving grace is that it is not trivial to put in your deck. It costs a lot of black and red mana symbols. And unlike Uro, you have to actually work for it. Like, it doesn't just feed itself. It's not really worth it to pay 2 mana to, like, make your opponent discard a card and lava spike them. So, you know, it is certainly weaker than Uro.
Yeah.
This is the point of the podcast where I have to issue a correction. It's not the last Titan standing in Standard. There's actually Cogla the Titan Ape.
All right.
So,
my bad.
Yeah, it's okay. It's sort of the less talked about third Titan.
My thing about this card is I agree certain problematic issues with Kroxa and Uro aside. I do like the fact that this was a cycle that they didn't take into all, like, into 5 color pairs, like, they just did 2 of them. I feel like that's the kind of thing that this direction they're moving in of, you know, we'll print partial, you know, pairs of cards, trios of cards, rather than feeling obligated to have everything be a 5 card cycle. I feel like that's a a nice direction to move in. So specific cards aside, I like that part.
So I like that part too, but I think that the Kroxa Uro thing was somewhat problematic because you basically didn't see Kroxa show up in Standard while Uro was legal, like at least not very much, because it was just so bad against the other one.
Well,
so
yes.
If they're going to do that, they need to be really careful that one isn't just like a direct counter of the other in such a powerful way.
It's interesting as well because, you know, discarding cards and making your opponent lose life tend to be more powerful effects in a vacuum than gaining life and drawing cards is. But the hardest counter, right? If both those effects happen against each other, the drawing cards and gaining life side is where you'd rather be.
Tristan, discarding a card is not more powerful than drawing a card. It is
making your opponent discard a card is what I meant to say, Benjamin.
Yeah, that is less powerful than drawing a card.
It's situational though, right? But like that, you know, they are often careful about pushing discard effects, right? Like Mind Twist, right?
There's no card that just costs a blue and X and draw X cards.
There's sort of ish Ancestral Recall.
I mean, like Raven's Crime sees a lot less play than Opt, for example.
Okay.
And they're like one is draw a card with some other with like a little bit of other stuff, and the other is they discard a card with a little bit of other stuff.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of when I was thinking about this, I was kind of thinking about Mind Rot and Divination, but Mind Rot is obviously different because you're. Actually,
also,
you
start Divination
way
and
less play than Divination.
Yeah. All right. Point conceded. I guess also a relevant thing is that you get that land play thingy on Uro, and Kroxa doesn't really have a counterpart to that.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because it doesn't always deal them damage.
Okay, yeah, I guess the dealy damage thing is the supposed to be the counterpart to the free land play thing.
Well, it's like if they did
the reverse of the life gain.
Well, kind of, but it's like if they didn't discard a land,
Kroxa costs one less mana.
Yeah, okay. That's true.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I guess
it's good that we're teaching Tristan these fundamentals in advance of any kind of like podcast battle we might get into.
I saw something on Twitter. Yeah,
I told Luis that we'd be willing to battle them whenever.
We'll take them on.
Certainly would be happy to weigh you guys down just at any time necessary.
I have done zero Zendikar drafts, so
I have done,
I don't even know what the commons are.
I have done also zero drafts, although not for lack of trying. I did try to do a draft, and then Arena kicked me out, and then I logged back in, and my draft was finished, and I hadn't made any picks. And I was not a happy camper. I was a sad camper.
That is a tragic tale.
Yes. Sam, would you like to tell us a tale about a card of the week from you?
Yeah, my card of the week is the Tabernacle at Pendril Vale. It's a legendary land from the set Legends, and it says all creatures now require an upkeep cost of 1 in addition to any other upkeep costs they may have. If the upkeep for a creature is not paid, the creature is destroyed. So this card is very, very powerful. It's a land that basically forces people to pay additional mana for their creatures every turn or lose them. And I don't know if I would say Legacy staple, but there are a handful of decks in the Legacy and Vintage formats that play at least one. Some Vintage decks even play quite a few of the Tabernacle at Pendril Vale. And they are very expensive. One of the notable things about this card is I don't know exactly what a copy costs, but it's above $1,000. And I have heard a lot of complaining about the Walking Dead cards being legal in Vintage and Legacy and how that will, you know, puts this like barrier to entry on the format and makes it hard to play. And I really don't think those complaints have not resonated with me in any way, really, because there are so many cards like the Tabernacle at Pendril Vale in Legacy already. And they stop you from playing certain decks. Like, if you want to play a lands deck, you pretty much need to have a copy of this card. But if you want to play the format, you can just play with other cards. And I think there are a lot of reasons to dislike the Walking Dead cards. Don't get me wrong about that. Like, I'm not a huge fan of just playing a normal game and having, like, leather jacket dude show up in my games. But I really, the accessibility issue is really just not really a big deal to me. And I'll even say that from now until the end of time, anyone who wants to, I will trade you any card of your choice from The Walking Dead for an authentic The Tabernacle at Pendrell Vale. That's just a standing offer. And I believe that I'll be getting the better of that exchange at every point.
It is certainly difficult to imagine these cards becoming more collectible than The Tabernacle at Pendrell Vale, to use a euphemism that Wizards coverage is used for.
I agree with you 100%, Sam. I don't know, like, it doesn't resonate with me when people are like, but like, you know, what if I play a commander game and my opponent plays this card? Like, you know, so like, what if I want to pick up this card for commander? Like, you know, Magic is a hobby. Magic cards shouldn't be free. You know, I like the idea that Wizards makes luxury products for people that can afford them. And, you know, if you can't afford them, you know, we live in a capitalistic society, for better or for worse, right now. And, you know, you should be okay with not needing to have all of these, like, hyper-collectible Magic cards. And so, it doesn't really resonate with me either, the accessibility issues, because it's not like anyone needs these cards. That's, like, purely opt-in. And, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think there are legitimate complaints about kind of going back on the word about having cards printed in this manner become pushed to the point of being playable in, you know, competitive Magic formats.
Oh, I mean, I think it's a bad idea for them to push them to be playable for a lot of other reasons. I think it feels less authentic, like less, it feels like more fake than what Legacy already is. But to me, it's on a similar level as including them in the, like, Commander products.
Right. I concur that, like, the problem with these cards isn't that they are, you know, a set of cards that are expensive to acquire that you might want to acquire for a Legacy deck. But there are several problems with these cards that include problems with the fact that they are printing potentially Legacy playable cards in this set. Like, that is part of the problem with some of these issues. Some of the problems that exist with The Walking Dead would not be a problem if these cards were all clearly unplayable, which they are not, right? Whether or not they're, you know, actively especially playable is an open question. You know, whether you will play one in 100 games in Legacy, one in 1,000, one in 1,000,000, or just zero, are all... that still remains to be seen, but the fact that it's not clearly zero is part of the problem for some of these effects.
It's definitely a part of the problem, but I think the ranges matter there.
Yes.
I don't think that I think it's very, very unlikely that even in the future we'll see any of these Secret Lair products at the power level that, like, True Name Nemesis was for Legacy, where you did actually have to plan part of your game around it and your sideboard. Like, I would be surprised if they printed any of these cards at such a rate that they show up at more than, like, 5% of the Legacy metagame at any point in their existence.
One problem with this, though, is that, you know, Wizards has this... They want these cards to be exciting and playable at this kind of, like, you know, box topper level, but it's clear that there's a pretty wide error band around the actual power level that cards land when they're aiming for that, right? Like, we've had cards like Nexus of Fate in that space in the past that have dramatically overshot the mark.
I think part of it is that they get a big boost from having these cards have IP tie-ins in that case. Like, that can take some of the excitement already.
That's true, but you know, if these cards cost two more each and were clearly garbage, they would be a lot less exciting to people as well, right? Like, would you really care about owning some exciting Magic cards if there's 6-mana 4/4 that doesn't do anything or whatever? Like, that's not a card you'd ever actually see yourself playing in any kind of setting, right? Whereas at the level they're pushed at now, you would play these cards in Commander, right? Like, these cards are in at least potentially exciting in various situations, right?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of think that that's a reasonable spot for them to land if, you know, once you're willing to give into the conceit that leather jacket guy should be
right. So that's the part that, to me, that's the most offensive part. The most offensive part is that like it's extremely jarring to have these kind of like bad photorealistic-y art things. First of all, that really jars with the art style of Magic, in my opinion, in a way that like even other promos I don't think have really like they're this is it, the art to me is as jarring as the worst promo art that exists out there for, you know, some of the most egregious cases of promos that have weird art on these cards. So seeing, you know, these on a table would certainly pull me out of the setting. And then also just, I mean, the direct IP tie-in is not something I'm a fan of either. I think that this is, I don't know, I feel like they're getting a huge amount of blowback over this. I haven't seen social media be as up in arms about something. Because, you know, social media is always up in arms about something, right? Like Magic Twitter, Magic Reddit is always, there's always a current problem that a series of complaint threads exist about. But I feel like this has uniquely captured some displeasure, so...
Oh, I mean, this is,
if this is the direction they don't go again.
Oh, I disagree. I don't know if you saw their
yeah. So they tried to defend it, right? But like that's what
they
would
came
do.
Pretty close to saying we already have another deal inked for these, or are very close to inking another deal.
Right. So if they have a deal already in motion, obviously that's not going to get changed. But like when they next get the opportunity to consider a deal for these, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends a little bit on the amount of money changing hands here. Certainly possible to imagine that there's just so much money they're getting as a result of making these. And the fact, I mean, anytime you can print potentially mechanically exciting cards and not have to sell them through distributors and just get people to buy directly from you, which is what they do with these Secret Lair cards, like that is a huge amount of extra profit that you get from these things, right? So that, I'm sure, sweetens the pot even further.
But yeah, it'll be interesting to see where these end up.
It certainly marks to me a new era of Magic cards that is a little bit less pure than the up till now phase. My card of the week is also a Secret Lair thing. This is a little bit more of an informational PSA. My card of the week is Walker. Walker is a card that if you read these Secret Lair cards, you'd see referenced, but not actually defined. So I figured I would define that for those who maybe don't know. Walker is a 2/2 black zombie creature token. And that is it. There's no... it is named Walker, I think.
That's correct.
It'll have a different name than zombie creature tokens, which can have rules relevance, but otherwise it's functionally the same as if these cards said to create a 2/2 black zombie creature token.
I think the walkers are colorless, right?
Oh, are these colorless? No way. They look black to me, but I just assumed they would be black. So I figured I would deliver that information, but it turns out I may have been lying to you. It's okay. That's not the kind of thing that's important to tell with the cards, but the cards literally look like the blackest card I have seen, you know, the art on them, but there's no color indicator. So yeah, you could be right.
Well, I'm checking. I don't know the answer. I thought they were black as well, but
yeah, I'm just looking at the Mythic spoiler page, and the art on these two that I see are directly the same as, you know, black zombies, where it's all murky and dark or black tinted gray. But I guess we'll I guess in my effort to clarify there.
I, for what it's worth, I actually liked the flavorful way that these didn't spend a lot of time breaking down what they said. I thought that's a good choice.
Yeah,
for this
so
product.
I think that kind of thing. Although it's important that, I don't know, if these aren't black zombie creature tokens, that is really counterintuitive, actually. Because if you showed me one of those cards, I would have just rattled off a guess of what a walker is. You know, a 2/2 black zombie creature token.
Yes, that's it. Right. That's what I liked about it was I read these cards and then I was like, I wonder what a walker is. I bet it's a 2/2 black zombie creature token. And then I think that was right. I guess maybe they're colorless. That would be weird. But if they, assuming that they are that, then I actually think that like for this kind of expert level product, like no one or very few people are probably getting this as their first Magic product. I guess maybe the Walking Dead fans might be, but having it just having the more normal English read, I think, is actually a good direction to go.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a reasonable argument for that sort of thing, you know, particularly like within a set, defining a term and then using it without having to, you know, redefine it on every card is definitely reasonable. But I figured it was worth calling out. Anyways, I guess Benjamin hasn't found anything about it either yet, so.
Oh, I just don't care. This card does not interest me.
Okay. Let's move on to our main topic then before we spend too long on this. This week we are going to discuss the format and metagame of the upcoming tournament. Beep. So
Worlds.
Yes, the Worlds tournament. Let's talk
about the name of it, I don't think.
the Worlds thing. So, Benjamin, let's start with the standard portion of this event. I guess before we start about the standard portion of this event, let's talk about what the format is. So what's the format of this tournament? What's the structure?
So it's a mixed format event, but they're both constructed. It's a standard and historic tournament. So the first three rounds are standard, the next six rounds are historic, and then the last three rounds are standard, I believe.
Okay, and is it Swiss with a cut?
Yeah, so it's 12 rounds of Swiss cut to top eight?
Top eight.
I think.
And then the historic rounds are slightly more valuable than standard.
No.
Yes, because the ones that would be standard.
If you're going to draw, it's going to be in the standard portion.
Oh, I see. Well, that's too bad, because I don't like my historic deck as much as I like my standard deck.
It's only slightly more. I mean, you're not going to be in a position to draw anyway, so it's not relevant.
Tristan!
So let's start with the standard portion. Benjamin, would you feel more comfortable if we did some standard decks and then a bunch of historic decks and then some standard decks?
Think we should probably do one and then the other.
Okay. Well,
they just wanted it this way probably so they could show both formats on both days. Because day one is rounds 1 through 6 and day two is rounds 7 through 12.
Right, but when they've done this with draft in the past, they could just alternate standard historic, right? Unless are you playing them all back to back and then they're being broadcast on different days, or
I have no idea.
Okay, well, either way, let's start with standard before more stupid discussion happens. Let's get to some smart discussion. So, first deck on our format overview here in standard is Omnath, which is a card that I'm surprised to see being playable, because they had a banned and restricted update recently and they left Omnath in the format, so I thought he was going to be fine. Is he fine?
The Omnath card is exceedingly busted. So this has been known for a while. People have been trying to build these like Omnath ramp decks that really exploit the mana mode of the card. Like playing Escape the Wilds and Genesis Ultimatum and Lotus Cobras and like Felidar Retreats and stuff like that as like a landfall deck that just like goes over the top of what your opponent is trying to do. That's like the deck I identify as like the Omnath ramp deck. I don't think that deck is very good, actually. So I think that deck has a lot of weaknesses to it. It's not very threat dense. So typically those decks will only have like some Ruin Crabs and some Omnaths and like some Felidar Retreats as cards that can actually kill your opponent. And the rest is just like mana and card draw. So if you play against a deck that has like efficient one-for-one answers that are sufficiently generic, so like a control deck or like a rogues deck or something like that, those decks can exploit the lack of threats in the Omnath ramp decks really well. Because the Omnath ramp decks, like, yeah, they'll find themselves running out of win conditions. Like, even if you can just draw a bunch of cards, you're just not actually going to be able to kill your opponent.
I enjoy describing Ruin Crab as a threat.
It is a threat. Have you ever heard of deck damage? Hello?
Sure, but I imagine if you're playing, you know, Rakdos or Rogues, it's unlikely that you lose to just, like, a Ruin Crab without any of the other good cards resolving, right?
Okay, Rakdos, yes, because that deck exploits the milling part. But Ruin Crab is definitely a threat. Like, when you play Glasspool Mimics, you can get multiple Ruin Crabs into play pretty quickly, and also the decks just play a lot of ways to put a bunch of lands into play. They have a lot of fetch lands, they have cultivates, stuff like that. Like cards you don't wouldn't like really consider threats or want to interact with. And multiple ruin crabs actually mills very, very fast. So when I tested this deck out, I was actually quite impressed with ruin crab.
Okay, that's fair. I haven't played with or against it, so okay. I was not sure.
Especially because Omnath itself like pushes out a lot of the aggro cards. Like, it's pretty hard to play an aggro deck when your opponent just gains 4 life a turn. So a lot of the decks have become mid-range or control decks, and so they actually do run the risk of dying to crabs. Like, deck damage is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think, like, Glasspool Mimic helps it out so much. Like, Glasspool Mimic is such a good card. I will not be surprised to see that card see heavy play while it's legal and standard.
Yeah, I've actually played against that one a little bit, even in, like, Pioneer, in, like, the Pioneer Spirits deck, just as a way for them to, you know, have a land that also generates more lords sometimes.
Yeah, and you can hit it off Company and stuff like that. Like, the card is so good.
Yeah.
So if that kind of ramp shell around Omnath wasn't it, what are there any other Omnath decks that may be it?
Yeah, so like the next deck that uses Omnath the best, I would say, is the Omnath Adventures deck, and this is actually the deck that I decided to register for the Grand Finals. This is basically just Teemer Adventures, and Teemer Adventures has always had like 4-ish slots that, you know, are kind of flex slots. Like, it's just a stack of adventure creatures, some Escape the Wilds, and then sort of a few random cards left over. And so the Omnath Adventures deck is like, okay, well, let's just play Omnaths there because Omnath is a busted card. And so this deck, basically, you get to play almost all of the most busted cards in Standard. Well, I do have an Embercleave in my deck, so I would say all the busted cards in Standard. I have Clover, I have Innkeeper, I have Omnath, and I have a sideboard Embercleave. So that's all of the best cards in Standard. And yeah, this deck is just super resilient. Like, there's no cards that you can really put in your deck that are, you're like, yeah, like, this card is going to be good against, you know, Teemer Clover, or this card is going to be good against Omnath Adventures. Like, you can put artifact removal in your deck to try to hit Lucky Clover, but, like, your opponent doesn't always draw Lucky Clover, and sometimes they're just going off with Edgewell Innkeeper. They're just playing, like, some sort of mid-range deck that gets card advantage by virtue of all of its spells being two-sided, like all of its spells having flashback, basically. And then Fae of Wishes just gives you a very powerful end game where you can just sort of get all the best cards for whatever situation you're in. The main way I've seen be effective against Omnath Adventures is to go over the top of it. So I think the Omnath Adventures deck has a bad matchup against like the Omnath Ramp deck. But I think that the ramp deck has too many other weaknesses, and it just makes it a bad choice. Whereas the Omnath Adventures deck is very threat dense. Like, almost every single one of your cards is a creature. Like, almost every single one of your cards kills something. When you have a Clover, you're very resilient to counter spells. And it's just a very solid deck. No one can really try to metagame you that well because your deck is so consistent and so interactive. I think it's just a really strong choice. I'm really happy with my Standard deck.
And this is like the deck to beat in Standard, right? Like the,
yeah, I think so.
I assume you expect this to be the most popular deck?
Yeah, it wasn't a secret or anything like that. Although I don't think everyone is playing it. I thought it was the best deck that I played. Like, I did like the other Standard decks, and maybe we can get into those a little more later. But like, each of them I felt like had sort of glaring weaknesses that I wasn't entirely comfortable with. I also tried to build my own decks, but my own decks were just too, like, the cards that I was trying to play with were just too weak compared to the powerhouses of, like, Lucky Clover and Omnath and Embercleave. So, yeah, I ended up here. I think a lot of other people ended up here, too. We did a very small amount of tuning, like, you know, maybe our list is, like, 3 or 4 cards different from, like, someone else's four color adventures deck or whatever.
So looking at there's a spreadsheet that somebody made of just aggregating all the people who have tweeted their decks or whatever, or otherwise made it known what they're playing. And it looks like there are 19 of the 32 people have publicly stated what they're playing. And of those, 9 of them are playing four color adventures. So roughly half the field.
Yeah.
Is there something that you think?
I think Omnath would be banned, probably. The Omnath card is just so ridiculous.
Will this deck not like? So one notable thing is that Gregor Kowalski is playing without Omnath. He's just playing Temur Adventures. Do you think that if they banned Omnath, this deck would not be great, or do you think they'd have to also ban like Clover or something like that?
I'm not sure. I think it's fine to just let Temur Clover exist. It's existed for a while now, and I don't think it's ever really been oppressive.
Sure, but it's always existed alongside other cards that have since been banned, right?
Yeah, that's true. But I think the problem is that playing against Omnath is really not fun. And the card is just... I don't understand why Gregor's chose not to play it. I mean, maybe he'll speak on it at some point, but I think it is crazy because it's not very hard to splash at all. The mana base is absolutely fine. The mana base is even great, I would say, thanks to the pathways and triumphs, both producing a bunch of colors. I don't understand why he didn't play Omnath.
And do you feel like you have anything special for the mirror, or is there anything good you can do in the mirror?
We decided that Embercleave was quite good in the mirror. Like, winning Beanstalk Giant fights was relevant. We tried having artifact removal, but we just ended up, like, not really liking it that much. And there's not a lot of sideboard slots in a deck with a Fae of Wishes board. And we found a much higher impact sideboard card in Chainweb Arachnir. So we're not really doing much special for the mirror. Just hopefully trying to have a more tuned list, a better mana base, and just, like, outplay our opponents, I guess.
So the theory there is like Chainweb Arachnir is a 10 in certain matchups, and you couldn't find a card that was a 10 in the Adventures Mirror, so you decided to go with the one that's actually good?
Yeah, exactly.
Makes sense.
Like, if you do actually play against Rogues, that it's so hard for them to beat Chainweb Arachnir. The card is absurdly strong, because they also just tutor you into it.
Right, they mill you right into it.
They tutor you into Chainweb Arachnir, and it removes your graveyard so that their cards are smaller, and it kills a creature when it comes into play, and it's a giant blocker.
So that's kind of the whole answer.
Yeah, I guess we can talk about Rogues now.
Perfect, let's do it.
I thought the Rogues deck was really impressive. I initially dismissed it as a pile of unplayable cards. But actually, Soaring Thought Thief is very good, as is the Thieves Guild Enforcer, and then obviously Xerath Saan is the like big punch, like your big card that you want that you can use to get ahead in the race, even if it puts your shields down. Rogues is fun if you like playing like a small creature aggro deck backed up by disruptive counterspells and removal spells. Like Drown in the Loch is really, really important, as it's just a hard counter spell to go with your milling cards, and it's also a removal spell if something slips through the cracks. I liked this deck a lot, but then I had to play against Chainweb Arachnir for the first time, or I had to play against Kroxa for the first time. And it really sucks that Wizards just like printed a mechanic that hard counters, like they printed a mechanic that got hard countered by a previous block mechanic. And it's just like, ugh. It's tough, because you really can't be milling... If you're playing against Rakdos, you really cannot be milling your opponent into Kroxa and just giving them access to Kroxa that they can cast every single turn, which also nerfs all of your other cards by exiling their graveyard.
Right, it's not only that they, like, draw a free busted card like Kroxa, but they also get to make your cards not work at the same time.
Yeah, and their card doesn't even have to resolve for it to make your cards not work. And, like, your best counterspell is Drown in the Loch, which sometimes can't even counterspell Kroxa when they have six cards in their graveyard.
Yeah, that's so brutal.
Yeah, so I liked the Rogues deck a lot until I had to play an escape card. Lucky Clover also gives it fits, just because the deck has a lot of counterspells, but Lucky Clover is very cheap, so if it slips through the cracks, it makes all their other spells like very difficult to counter, and then you're just in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I see, and that's... Pretty much everybody you're going to be facing is either a Lucky Clover deck or an Escape deck, right?
Yeah, I think so. No, well, there's some, like, mono-green decks. I think you have a pretty decent matchup against mono-green, as long as you, like, because you have, like, Death Touch creatures and, like, cheap removal spells, and Xerath Saan is also really good against mono-green. But they do have a lot of, like, very annoying cards for you in that they have like reach creatures and like Stone Coil Serpent is very good. And they might be boarding Chain Web Arachnir, so God forbid.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about the mono green strategy. Is that something you think has any merit?
I think if you wanted to play an aggro deck, then mono green is the best one. Or some people are playing Gruul, which is, as I understand it, basically so that they can play Embercleave, which, I mean, Embercleave is a really, really strong card, so it makes a lot of sense. And, like, yeah, I think this is something you can do if you're obsessed with playing aggro, but I just don't think it's reasonable to be playing cards like this when you could be playing Omnath. Like, it just puts you out of range so fast. And, I mean, the fact that it's mono green, like, they're really trying to rely on the fact that mono green plays to the board and tries to get a big board advantage and just with huge creatures. And eventually you're put into the point where, like, you can't double block or you can't remove the creatures. And then you just die by a lot instead of by a little. As opposed to a mono red deck, which would be, you know, trying to get in with little creatures and then finish you off with burn, which is obviously not going to work against Omnath. Whereas mono green, it's possible because you could just outclass the 4-4 and then win by like a lot instead of by a little. And that's why I think you see the aggro deck being mono green rather than mono red or mono white or whatever. But I just, you know, I can't bring myself to not register Omnath. Like, people say they have a good matchup against Adventures with these decks. Like, Adventures has so much interaction. Like, they're playing Giant Killer, you know, and Brazen Borrower. So I just find it hard to believe that these decks are actually good against Adventures, but who knows? They might be. We'll have to see.
Okay. Looks like we've talked about most of the ones on this list, except for maybe Rakdos. Is there anything worth...
I think Rakdos is a really interesting deck. It's basically like a black-red mid-range deck, which is, like, you know, my cup of tea. And it utilizes the escape cards in order to have a lot of spells to play in the late game or to get a lot of card advantage, like Ox of Agonis or Kroxa. And then it just backs up, like, you have removal and discard to go with it. But at the end of the day, you're just playing it like an inherently fair strat. I mean, Kroxa gives you, like, sort of an unfair angle. Like, once you lock someone under Kroxa, they die very quickly, and it's very hard for them to get out. So it definitely, like, the draw is in consistently casting Kroxa. But in my experience, this deck really struggles against Lucky Clover. If a Lucky Clover gets down, it's really hard for you to grind that player out because they can easily wish for answers to Kroxa, and they can just accrue advantage constantly over the game. But I would expect black-red to be very good against something like mono-green or whatever, where you just have a bunch of good, cheap removal that you can cast on their early creatures, and then, like, get a Kroxa into play, which they can't really, like, which outsizes most of their stuff, assuming that you can kill the other stuff, and then, like, we'll kill them pretty quickly from there. Just the black-red cards line up pretty efficiently, I think, against the mono-green cards. And then, obviously, if you ever play against Rogues, it's basically a buy because they mill you into Kroxa.
Yeah, that interaction. has anybody registered Rogues for this tournament? Is that... That seems like it's just too rough in the metagame.
No one on the...
I think Seth did.
No. Tweet was very unclear. This seems like it's just a total guess to me. Seth just said he is not playing Omnath.
But he also replied to Luis saying, "Oh, I'm going to beat you up with Thought Sail Thief."
Oh, okay. Maybe.
So
maybe
Seth certainly implied he's playing Rogues. He didn't like straight out tweet his deck list or whatever. But I think you'd have to be insane to register Rogues. Like maybe 2 weeks ago or like a week ago, Rogues would have been good. But the metagame shifted. People identified the weaknesses of that deck, and I do not believe that it is playable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is just hard countered by the escape mechanic.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the historic metagame that has developed here. So, first of all, what are the good decks in historic kind of level one?
So, going into this tournament, we expected Sultai, Jund, and Goblins to be the best, or to be the most representative decks, based on the previous Mythic Invitational, where Jund overperformed by a lot. as well as Sultai. And then Goblins was just sort of like the deck to beat going into that tournament. It hasn't really broken out that way. Based on the people tweeting their deck lists, a lot of the field seems to be on a four-color Omnath ramp strategy, which, as far as I can tell, is just a standard deck with Growth Spirals and Explores, which is sort of funny to me, because I thought that standard deck was very bad, like, just not good enough, and then people just add some Explores and Growth Spirals and call it a day. But it might work out in their favor, because, like, my team ended up on Sultai, and I do not like our four-color Omnath matchup.
So what do you think is tough about that matchup?
So in our Sultai deck, we have like some Aether Gusts and some Thought Seizes, and those are good cards. But our deck is not particularly fast. Like, you might be able to play Nissa on turn four and then like keep up Aether Gust, and in any game like that, you'll probably win. But you know, you don't always draw Nissa that early, and if you don't, you can't really put any pressure on your opponent. And Omnath is pretty effective at stopping Nissa pressure, being a 4-4. and like the rest of the cards in our deck just don't really line up very well against what the Omnath deck is doing. The Omnath deck is just trying to go over the top of our Sultai deck. And we trimmed a little bit on counterspells because we didn't think counterspells were going to be good against Jund or Goblins. Or the Mirror, for that matter. So, yeah, we just don't really have a lot in our sideboard for the matchup, and we don't have a ton of good cards in our main deck for the matchup either, which is just going to make it pretty tough.
So you're saying your bacon might be cooked in this particular spot.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, you know, the matchup's not unwinnable, obviously. Like, sometimes you can just draw Thoughtseize into Growth Spiral into Nissa into Aether Gust, and then you're going to win that game probably, but you know,
I noticed you didn't mention Yasharn in that equation.
Yeah, I mean, Yasharn is not exactly great in this matchup, I would say. We did end up playing two main... I should have said our Sultai tech was to play two main deck Yasharns and two more in the sideboard, because we expected a lot of Jund. Like, when we were testing, we thought Jund was a really good deck. It's just very resilient and capable of grinding with the best of them, but also capable of like relatively fast starts, like Mayhem Devil and Woe Strider do attack for a decent amount of damage, and obviously Mayhem Devil combo kills are really good. But I guess like there's just very little Jund in the format from what I've seen so far, so not everyone shared our conclusions, I think, or maybe they're just scared off by the printing of Yasharn, because we were certainly coming prepared to beat Jund.
It looks like, from what I can see from this list, that most people have just adopted Yasharn themselves rather than play Jund that, you know, is potentially weak to Yasharn. Like, of the 19 people who have submitted decks, it looks like 14 of them have Yasharn in them. So that's at least, you know, or already, even if the remaining, even if the remaining 13 people have no Yasharns, that's an awful lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably what happened. Yeah, I don't know. It's tough. Yasharn is obviously very difficult for the Jund deck to beat because it's very based around sacrificing. Our Jund deck that we were playing with had a bunch of Murderous Riders in it and Trail of Crumbs to find the Murderous Riders because of Yasharn. And I thought that deck was still good. Like, you can occasionally beat Yasharn by way of Korvald, but it's difficult. Yasharn is definitely like a 10 out of 10 against Jund. Honestly, I kind of wish that I had played Jund, given the way the metagame broke down, because I'm pretty sure that just having a fast Korvald, like if I had played Jund with four Korvalds, I would have a very good matchup against this Omnath deck, I think.
So how does Yasharn interact with Korvald? Because it says players can't sacrifice, but I assume that's just to pay costs, right?
Correct. You can't pay costs. You can't sacrifice things to pay costs when Yasharn is in play, but Korvald sacrifices things as part of a trigger, the resolution of a trigger. So you will sacrifice when Korvald enters and when he attacks. And, you know, it doesn't take that many attacks with a gigantic flyer to win the game, even through Yasharn. And you still get to draw cards. You can, like, put blockers into play, or maybe you can, like, find a Murderous Rider or something, you know. Something.
And you can still sac, like, fetch lands or whatever.
Yeah, you can still sac Fabled Passage. And also maybe you could play Korvald before the pig comes down and you can draw like two cards and put 2++1 counters on it or something. And now all of a sudden they can't really play Yasharn into that board because they have to deal with the Korvald somehow. So it delays them. And then, you know, there is some counterplay there. But yeah, I kind of wish that I had registered a bunch of Korvalds.
All right.
I feel you there.
One deck on this list that we haven't talked much about yet is Goblins. Is that something that you considered, and what were your thoughts about it?
I don't think I ever seriously considered it. I played with it as a gauntlet deck in our testing, just to make sure that people could pass the Muxus test or whatever. But I think Goblins is a deck that, in order to be good, is going to have to get off the radar for a while, because it's just been too on the radar and it's just too beatable. Like, the deck is just too reliant on Muxus to win, is my experience. Like, the rest of their cards don't really, you know, aren't really 2020 cards. So they can't really hold up the fort if your opponent is good at stopping you from Muxusing. And pretty much everybody's good at stopping you from Muxusing these days. I think Goblins has a very bad matchup against Jund and a pretty bad matchup against Sultai. So I didn't really expect it in huge numbers, but I still wanted to make sure my decks passed the Goblins test, because I felt like some people would show up with the deck just because it is a pretty, you know, Muxus is a very powerful card. And I think right now one person has tweeted that they're playing Goblins.
That is correct.
So it looks like the metagame is largely absent of that.
Yeah.
What's your take about the health of Omnath and Historic? Is that something you're less concerned about? I mean, obviously it's by definition less concerning than Standard.
We tried an Omnath deck in the very beginning, but sort of discarded it pretty quickly. I didn't work on that myself, so I'm not entirely, like, I don't know the full story there, but yeah, we'll have to see if it's all that it's cracked up to be in the tournament itself. It is gonna, you know, beat up on our poor Sultai decks, I think, but we'll see how it does against a wider field, maybe. I will say that one of the Raph Levy worked on, like, a mono black aggro deck, a suicide black aggro deck with the new Scourge of the Skyclaves card. And man, I wish we had played that card, or I wish we had played that deck looking at this field, because I have a feeling that a Thoughtseize aggro deck would be really good against Omnath, but, you know, c'est la vie.
Lovey.
What?
I don't know, you told me to c'est la vie, so I did.
Oh. Hey, wow, I just realized that was a joke, too.
Kind of works on two levels, because we were just talking about... Okay, good.
Matt Ness also worked on a Neoform deck for a really long time, Matt Ness and Sam Sherman. And I was pretty close to playing Neoform at first, but eventually we just thought that it just wasn't quite good enough. It was close. Like, it wouldn't be embarrassing to play, but, you know, we were losing a little too much. We were, like, not being able to find the combo a little bit too much. And it's tough to have your combo deck be vulnerable to Aether Gust as well. So we eventually decided not to play it.
Yeah, I remember 2 weeks ago when we were about to start our episode, then we had to be hush-hush about how great the Neoform deck was. So sad to see it dropped off from that.
Yeah, it's too bad.
MJ is playing it. I'm interested to see how he does. It does seem like it's very weak to Yasharn, actually.
Yeah, that's another thing, that it's tough that you can't cast Neoform with Yasharn in play. But the deck does have Fae of Wishes, so there's like a quasi-duplicate kill that you can Fae of Wishes for if you have dual caster mage, so that gets around that.
All right, well, I think that about wraps up our look at the Historic format. And taking a look at the clock here, it looks like that's been a reasonable discussion of what's going on for this tournament. Are there any, headlines, any closing thoughts you'd have about either Standard or Historic? Ben. Okay, go ahead. Let's do that.
Ben, if someone were to draft you in a fantasy draft, with what pick do you think you should be selected, given what you know right now about the field and the formats?
Oof. Given what I know right now. Probably bottom third.
Okay, so there you have it. We'll check back next week to see if Ben manages to outperform. I guess like 22nd place would be bottom third.
It does depend a little bit on the criteria of this hypothetical draft, right? Because, you know, if it's an all or nothing thing, you may want to draft, you know, less consistent and more spiky, more likely to spike type gamers. Whereas if it's more just like you earn points based on the number of points they earn, Benjamin, I think, would be a better pick because he's got that uncanny ability to go 11-5 in any tournament on demand.
Like, I feel like I'm somewhere between the bottom third and halfway point in terms of, like, player skill of players qualified for the tournament. But I feel like my deck choice for Historic is not good. So that's why I, like, rounded down to bottom third. That was, like, what my thought process was.
So there you have it. Unbridled pessimism coming from Ben White's.
I'd like to think it's realism. I think
sorry, it's bridal pessimism, let's say.
It's good to try to have a realistic assessment of one's skills, I feel. And I don't know, hopefully that's a realistic assessment of mine. I don't really know for sure, but
yeah, I mean,
there's obviously a lot of fantastic players in the field. And then there's also a lot of people that like I don't really know because they just were like me and just spiked one of two tournaments. So
you know, I mean,
we'll have to see.
Worlds is definitely, it's the kind of tournament that you can lose just an embarrassing amount of matches in, but, you know, there's...
Not that anyone here would have any experience with that.
Luckily, there's no way to lose pro points or anything from this, so yeah. That's all. You always got that
going
for you.
There's also, unfortunately, no way to gain pro points. But
right? Not that that would have necessarily been relevant, though. Anyways... Let's close out our show this week with a Matt Nass story, in fact. Who would like to tell this one?
Sam would like to tell it.
I'll take a crack at it. So this came from, I was helping, in quotes, Matt and Ben test for this event. I was hanging out in their Discord, mostly just because I wanted to chat with my pals. And I'm watching Matt Nass play, I'm actually watching from Ben's side. And at a certain point, Matt plays a Brazen Borrower during Ben's second main phase in response to some spell that Ben played. You know, he was going to play at end of turn, but he's like, yeah, whatever, I'll just get it out of the way. And I said, Matt, I think that was kind of loose. Like, what if Ben had some sorcery speed removal? And Matt goes, well, no, I have Ben's deck list, and he has no sorcery speed removal in his deck list. And I'm looking at Ben's hand, and he has a sorcery speed removal spell. He has the red one, deal four. I don't remember the name of that card, but Thundering Rebuke in his hand. And I'm like, well, that's not true. And also, and then Ben goes, and also I never posted my deck list. You don't have my deck list. So Matt was really, you know, sabotaging their testing, I would say. And if Ben finishes in the bottom third, we know who to blame.
That is going to be all for us this week, though. We will unite again next week with more strategies. Matt Nass just has this kind of ability to just, with complete confidence, double down on blatant falsehoods he's just told, huh?
It is.
Yeah, I'm literally watching Ben's game.
Matt Nass is the king of being overconfident, I feel. He would be a bad crew in Among Us. Oh my god, I had such a great Among Us game today. I made a kill and framed, like, I guess I framed multiple people for it, because for the next, like, two or three meetings, Luis and Cho just kept screaming at each other that the other one was an imposter. It was unbelievable how much they were arguing.